Chapter 18. Automatic Writing. 1. He waited until Liz had gone to bed before going up to his study. He paused outside their bedroom door for a minute or so on his way, listening to the regular ebb and flow of her breathing, assuring himself that she was asleep. He wasn't at all sure that what he was going to try would work, but if it did, it might be dangerous. Extremely dangerous. His study was one large room, a renovated barn loft, which had been divided into two areas. The reading room, which was a book-lined area with a couch, a reclining chair, and track lighting. And at the far end of the long room, his work area. This part of the study was dominated by an old-fashioned business desk without a single feature to redeem its remarkable ugliness. It was a scarred, battered, uncompromisingly utilitarian piece of furniture. Thad had owned it since he was 26, and Liz sometimes told people he wouldn't let it go because he secretly believed that it was his own private fountain of words. They would both smile when she said this, as if they really believed it was a joke. Three glass-shaded lights hung down over this dinosaur, and when Thad turned on only these lights, as he did now, the savage, overlapping circles of light they made on the desk's littered landscape made it seem as if he were about to play some strange version of billiards there. What the rules for play on such a complex surface might be, it was impossible to tell, but on the night after Wendy's accident, the tight set of his face would have convinced an observer that the game would be for very high stakes, whatever the rules. Thad would have agreed with that 100%. It had, after all, taken him over 24 hours to work his courage up to this. He looked at the Remington Standard for a moment, a vague hump under its cover with the stainless steel return lever sticking out from the left side like a hitchhiker's thumb. He sat down in front of it, drummed his fingers restlessly on the edge of the desk for a few moments, then opened the drawer to the left of the typewriter. This drawer was both wide and deep. He took his journal out of it, then opened the drawer all the way to its stop. The mason jar in which he kept the Beryl Black Beauties had rolled all the way to the back, spilling pencils as it went. He took it out, set it in its accustomed place, then gathered up the pencils and put them back into it. He shut the drawer and looked at the jar. He had tossed it in the drawer after that first fugue, during which he had used one of the Black Beauties to write "The Sparrows Are Flying Again" on the manuscript of The Golden Dog. He had never intended to use one again. Yet he had been fooling with one just a couple of nights ago, and here they were, sitting where they had sat during the dozen or so years when Stark had lived with him, lived in him. For long periods, Stark would be quiet, hardly there at all. Then an idea would strike, and foxy old George would leap out of his head like a crazed jack-in-the-box. "Kapop! Here I am, Thad. Let's go, old hoss. Saddle up." And every day for about 3 months thereafter, Stark would leap out promptly at 10 o'clock every day, weekends included. He would pop out, seize one of the Beryl pencils, and commence writing his crazed nonsense. The crazed nonsense which paid the bills Thad's own work could not pay. Then the book would be done and George would disappear again, like the crazy old man who had woven straw into gold for Rapunzel. Thad took out one of the pencils, looked at the teeth mark slightly tattooed on the wooden barrel, and then dropped it back into the jar. It made a tiny clink sound. "My dark half," he muttered. But was George Stark his? Had he ever been his? Except for the fugue or trance or whatever it had been, he had not used one of these pencils, not even to make notes, since writing "The End" at the bottom of the last page of the last Stark novel, "Riding to Babylon." There had been nothing to use them for, after all. They were George Stark's pencils, and Stark was dead. Or so he had assumed. He supposed he would have gotten around to throwing them out in time. But now it seemed he had a use for them after all. He reached toward the wide-mouthed jar, then pulled his hand back, as if from the side of a furnace which glows with its own deep and jealous heat. Not yet. He took the scripto pen from his shirt pocket, opened his journal, uncapped the pen, hesitated, and then wrote. "If William cries, Wendy cries, but I've discovered the link between them is much deeper and stronger than that. Yesterday, Wendy fell down the stairs and earned a bruise that looks like a big purple mushroom. When the twins got up from their naps, William had one too. Same location, same shape. Thad lapsed into the self-interview style which characterized a good part of his journal. As he did so, he realized this very habit, this way of finding a path to the things he really thought, suggested yet another form of duality. Or perhaps it was only another aspect of a single split in his mind and spirit, something which was both fundamental and mysterious. Question. If you took slides of the bruises on my children's legs, then overlaid them, would you end up with what looked like a single image? Answer. Yes, I think you would. I think it is like the fingerprints. I think it is like the voice prints. Thad sat quietly for a moment, tapping the end of the pen against the journal page, considering this. Then he leaned forward again and began to write more quickly. Question. Does William know he has a bruise? Answer. No, I don't think he does. Question. Do I know what the sparrows are or what they mean? Answer. No. Question. But I do know there are sparrows. I know that much, don't I? Whatever Alan Pangborn or anyone else may believe, I know there are sparrows, and I know that they are flying again, don't I? Answer. Yes. Now the pen was racing over the page. He had not written so quickly or unselfconsciously in months. Question. Does Stark know there are sparrows? Answer. No, he said he doesn't, and I believe him. Question. Am I sure I believe him? He stopped again, briefly, and then wrote, Stark knows there is something, but William must know there is something, too. If his leg is bruised, it must hurt. But Wendy gave him the bruise when she fell downstairs. William only knows he has a hurt place. Question. Does Stark know he has a hurt place, a vulnerable place? Answer. Yes, I think he does. Question. Are the birds mine? Answer. Yes. Question. Does that mean that when he wrote the sparrows are flying again on Clausen's wall and Miriam's wall, he didn't know what he was doing and didn't remember it when he was done? Answer. Yes. Question. Who wrote about the sparrows? Who wrote it in blood? Answer. The one who knows. The one to whom the sparrows belong. Question. Who is the one who knows? Who owns the sparrows? Answer. I am the knower. I am the owner. Question. Was I there? Was I there when he murdered them? He paused again, briefly. Yes, he wrote. And then, no. Both. I didn't have a fugue when Stark killed either Homer Gamache or Clausen, at least not that I remember. I think that what I know, what I see, may be growing. Question. Does he see you? Answer. I don't know, but... He must, Thad muttered. He wrote, he must know me. He must see me. If he really did write the novels, he has known me for a long time, and his own knowing, his own seeing is also growing. All that traceback and recording equipment didn't faze foxy old George a bit, did it? No, of course not. Because foxy old George knew it would be there. You don't spend almost 10 years writing crime fiction without finding out about stuff like that. That's one reason it didn't faze him. But the other one's even better, isn't it? When he wanted to talk to me privately, he knew exactly where I'd be and how to get hold of me, didn't he? Yes. Stark had called the house when he wanted to be overheard, and he had called Dave's Market when he didn't. Why had he wanted to be overheard in the first case? Because he had a message to send to the police he knew would be listening, that he wasn't George Stark, and knew he wasn't. And that he was done killing. He wasn't coming after Thad and Thad's family. And there was another reason, too. He wanted Thad to see the voice prints he knew they would make. He knew the police wouldn't believe their evidence, no matter how incontrovertible it seemed. But Thad would. Question. How did he know where I'd be? And that was a mighty good question, wasn't it? That was right up there with such questions as how can two different men share the same fingerprints and voice prints? And how can two different babies have exactly the same bruise, especially when only one of the babies in question happened to bump her leg? Except he knew that similar mysteries were well documented and accepted, at least in cases where twins were involved. The bond between identicals was even more eerie. There had been an article about it in one of the news magazines a year or so ago. Because of the twins in his own life, Thad had read the article closely. There was the case of identical twins who were separated by an entire continent, but when one of them broke his left leg, the other suffered excruciating pains in his own left leg without even knowing something had happened to his sib. There were the identical girls who had developed their own special language, a language known and understood by no one else on Earth. These twin girls had never learned English in spite of their identical high IQs. What need for English had they? They had each other, and that was all they wanted. And, the article said, there were the twins who, separated at birth, were reunited as adults and found they had both married on the same day of the same year, women with the same first name and strikingly similar looks. Furthermore, both couples had named their first sons Robert. Both Roberts had been born in the same month and in the same year. Half and half. Chris and Cross. Snick and Snee. Ike and Mike, they think alike, Thad muttered. He reached out and circled the last line he had written. Question. How did he know where I'd be? Below this, he wrote, Answer. Because the sparrows are flying again. And because we are twins. He turned to a fresh page in his journal and laid the pen aside. Heart thumping hard, skin freezing with fear, he reached out a trembling right hand and pulled one of the barrel pencils from the jar. It seemed to burn with a low and unpleasant heat in his hand. Time to go to work. Thad Beaumont leaned over the blank page, paused, and then printed, "The sparrows are flying again," in large block letters at the top. 2. What exactly did he mean to do with the pencil? But he knew that, too. He was going to try and answer the last question, the one so obvious he hadn't even bothered to write it down. Could he consciously induce the trance state? Could he make the sparrows fly? The idea embodied a form of psychic contact he had read about but had never seen demonstrated. Automatic writing. The person attempting to contact a dead soul, or a living one, by this method, held a pen or pencil loosely in his hand with the tip on a blank sheet of paper and simply waited for the spirit, pun most definitely intended, to move him. Thad had read that automatic writing, which could be practiced with the aid of a Ouija board, was often approached as a kind of lark, a party game even, and that this could be extremely dangerous, that it could, in fact, lay the practitioner wide open to some form of possession. Thad had neither believed nor disbelieved this when reading it. It seemed as foreign to his own life as the worship of pagan idols or the practice of trepanning to relieve headaches. Now it seemed to have its own deadly logic, but he would have to summon the sparrows. He thought of them. He tried to summon up the image of all those birds, all those thousands of birds, sitting on roof peaks and telephone wires beneath a mild spring sky, waiting for the telepathic signal to take off. And the image came. But it was flat and unreal, a kind of mental painting with no life in it. When he began writing, it was often like this, a dry and sterile exercise. No, it was worse than that. Starting off always felt a little obscene to him, like French kissing a corpse. But he had learned that if he kept at it, if he simply kept pushing the words along the page, something else kicked in, something which was both wonderful and terrible. The words as individual units began to disappear. Characters who were stilted and lifeless began to limber up, as if he had kept them in some small closet overnight and they had to loosen their muscles before they could begin their complicated dances. Something began to happen in his brain. He could almost feel the shape of the electrical waves there changing, losing their prissy goose-step discipline, turning into the soft, sloppy delta waves of dreaming sleep. Now Thad sat hunched over his journal, pencil in hand, and tried to make this happen. As the moments spun themselves out and nothing did happen, he began to feel more and more foolish. A line from the old Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon show got into his head and refused to leave. "Eeny, meeny, chilly, beeny, the spirits are about to speak." What in God's name was he going to say to Liz if she showed up and asked him what he was doing here with a pencil in his hand and a blank sheet of paper in front of him at just a few minutes before midnight? That he was trying to draw the bunny on the matchbook and win a scholarship to the famous artist's school in New Haven? Hell, he didn't even have one of those matchbooks. He moved to put the pencil back, and then paused. He had turned in his chair a little, so he was looking out the window to the left of his desk. There was a bird out there, sitting on the window ledge and looking in at him with bright black eyes. It was a sparrow. As he watched, it was joined by another. And another. "Oh, my God," he said in a trembling, watery voice. He had never been so terrified in his life. And suddenly that sensation of going filled him again. It was as it had been when he spoke to Stark on the telephone, but now it was stronger, much stronger. Another sparrow landed, jostling the other three aside for place, and beyond them he saw a whole line of birds sitting on top of the carriage house where they kept the lawn equipment and Liz's car. The antique weather vane on the carriage house's single gable was covered with them, swinging beneath their weight. "Oh, my God," he repeated, and he heard his voice from a million miles away, a voice which was filled with horror and terrible wonder. "Oh, my dear God, they're real. The sparrows are real." In all his imaginings, he had never suspected this. But there was no time to consider it, no mind to consider it with. Suddenly, the study was gone, and in its place he saw the Ridgeway section of Bergenfield, where he had grown up. It lay as silent and deserted as the house in his stark nightmare. He found himself peering at a silent suburb in a dead world. Yet it was not entirely dead, because the roof of every house was lined with twittering sparrows. Every TV antenna was freighted with them. Every tree was filled with them. They queued upon every telephone line. They sat on the tops of parked cars, on the big blue mailbox which stood at the corner of Duke Street and Marlborough Lane, and on the bike rack in front of the Duke Street convenience store, where he had gone to buy milk and bread for his mother when he was a boy. The world was filled with sparrows, waiting for the command to fly. Thad Beaumont lolled back in his office chair, a thin froth spilling from the corners of his mouth, feet twitching aimlessly, and now all the windows of the study were lined with sparrows, looking in at him like strange avian spectators. A long gargling sound escaped his mouth. His eyes rolled up in his head, revealing bulging, glistening whites. The pencil touched the sheet and began to write. "Sis," it scrawled across the top line. It dropped two lines, made the L-shaped indent mark that was characteristic of each new Stark paragraph, and wrote, "The woman began to step away from the door. She did this almost at once, even before the door had stopped its short inward swing. But it was too late. My hand shot out through the 2-inch gap between the door and the jamb and clamped over her hand. The sparrows flew. All at once, they all took flight, the ones in his head from that long-ago Bergenfield, and the ones outside his Ludlow home, the real ones. They flew up into two skies, a white spring sky in the year 1960 and a dark summer sky in the year 1988. They flew, and they were gone in a ruffling blast of wings. Thad sat up, but his hand was still nailed to the pencil, being pulled along. The pencil was writing by itself. I made it, he thought dazedly, wiping spit and froth from his mouth and chin with his left hand. I made it, and I wish to God I had let it alone. What is this? He stared down at the words pouring out of his fist, his heart thumping so hard he felt the pulse high and fast in his throat. The sentences spilling out on the blue lines were in his own handwriting, but then all of Stark's novels had been written in his hand. With the same fingerprints, the same taste in cigarettes, and exactly the same vocal characteristics, it would be odder if it were someone else's handwriting, he thought. His handwriting, just as it had been all the other times. But where were the words coming from? Not from his own head, that was certain. There was nothing up there right now but terror overlaid with loud, roaring confusion. And there was no feeling in his hand anymore. His right arm seemed to end roughly 3 inches above his wrist. There was not even a remote sense of pressure in his fingers, although he could see he was gripping the barrel tightly enough to turn his thumb and first two fingers white at the tips. It was as if he had been given a healthy shot of Novocaine. He reached the bottom of the first sheet. His unfeeling hand tore it back, his unfeeling palm raced up the journal's binding, creasing the page flat, and began to write again. Miriam Cowley opened her mouth to scream. I had been standing just inside the door, waiting patiently for just over 4 hours, not drinking coffee, not smoking cigarettes. I'd wanted one and would have one as soon as it was over, but before the smell might have alerted her. I reminded myself to close her eyes after cutting her throat. Thad realized with mounting horror that he was reading an account of Miriam Cowley's murder, and this time it was not a broken, confused stew of words, but the coherent, brutal narration of a man who was, in his own horrid way, an extremely effective writer, effective enough so that millions of people had bought his fiction. George Stark's non-fiction debut, he thought sickly. He had done exactly what he had set out to do, had made contact, had somehow tapped into Stark's mind, just as Stark must somehow have tapped into Thad's own mind. But who would have guessed what monstrous unknown forces he would touch in doing so? Who could have guessed? The Sparrows, and the realization that the Sparrows were real, had been bad, but this was worse. Had he thought both the pencil and the notebook were warm to the touch? No wonder. This man's mind was a fucking furnace. And now, Jesus, here it was, unrolling out of his own fist. Jesus Christ. "You're thinking you could brain me with that thing, aren't you, sis?" I asked her. "Let me tell you something. That's not a happy thought. And you know what happens to people who lose their happy thoughts, don't you?" The tears were running down her cheeks now. "What's wrong, George? Are you losing some of your happy thoughts?" No wonder it had stopped the black-hearted son of a bitch for a moment when he had said that. If this was the way it really had been, then Stark had used the same phrase before killing Miriam. "I was tapped into his mind during the murder. I was. That's why I used that phrase during the conversation we had at Dave's." Here was Stark forcing Miriam to call Thad, dialing the number for her because she was too terrified to remember it, although there were weeks when she must have dialed it half a dozen times. Thad found this forgetfulness and Stark's understanding of it both horrible and persuasive. And now Stark was using his razor to... But he didn't want to read that, wouldn't read that. He pulled his arm up, lifting his numb hand along with it like a lead weight. The instant the pencil's contact with the notebook was broken, feeling flooded back into the hand. The muscles were cramped, and the side of his second finger ached dully. The barrel of the pencil had left an indentation which was now turning red. He looked down at the scrawled page, full of horror and a dumb species of wonder. The last thing on earth he wanted to do was to put that pencil back down again, to complete that obscene circuit between Stark and himself again. But he hadn't gotten into this just to read Stark's first-hand account of Mir Cowley's murder, had he? "Suppose the birds come back." But they wouldn't. The birds had served their purpose. The circuit he had achieved was still whole and functioning. Thad had no idea how he knew that, but he did know. "Where are you, George?" he thought. "How come I don't feel you? Is it because you are as unaware of my presence as I am of yours? Or is it something else? Where the fuck are you?" He held the thought in front of his mind, trying to visualize it as a bright red neon sign. Then he gripped the pencil again and began lowering it toward his journal. As soon as the tip of the pencil touched the paper, his hand rose again and flipped to a blank sheet. The palm flattened the turned sheet along the crease as it had done once before. Then the pencil returned it to the paper and wrote, "It doesn't matter," Machine told Jack Rangeley. "All places are the same." He paused. "Except maybe home. And I'll know that when I get there." "All places are the same." He recognized that line first, then the whole quote. It was from the first chapter of Stark's first novel, Machine's Way. The pencil had stopped of its own accord this time. He raised it and looked down at the scribbled words, cold and prickling. "Except maybe home, and I'll know that when I get there." In Machine's Way, home had been Flatbush Avenue, where Alexis Machine had spent his childhood, sweeping up in the billiard parlor of his diseased alcoholic father. Where was home in this story? Where is home? He thought at the pencil, and slowly lowered it to the paper again. The pencil made a quick series of sloping M shapes. It paused, then moved again. "Home is where the start is," the pencil wrote below the birds. A pun. Did it mean anything? Was the contact really still there, or was he fooling himself now? He hadn't been fooling himself about the birds, and he hadn't been fooling himself during that first frenzied spate of writing. He knew that. But the feeling of heat and compulsion seemed to have abated. His hand still felt numb, but how tightly he was gripping the pencil, and that was very tightly indeed, judging from the mark on the side of his finger, could have something to do with that. Hadn't he read in that same piece on automatic writing that people often fooled themselves with the Ouija board? That in most cases it was guided not by the spirits, but by the subconscious thoughts and desires of the operator? Home is where the start is. If it was still stark, and if the pun had some meaning, it meant here, in this house, didn't it? Because George Stark had been born here. Suddenly, part of the damned People magazine article floated into his mind. I rolled a sheet of paper into my typewriter, and then I rolled it right back out again. I've typed all my books, but George Stark apparently didn't hold with typewriters. Maybe because they didn't have typing classes in any of the stone hotels where he did time. Cute, very cute. But it had only a second cousinship with the actual facts, didn't it? It wasn't the first time Thad had told a story that had only a tenuous relationship to the truth, and he supposed it wouldn't be the last, assuming he lived through this, of course. It wasn't exactly lying. It wasn't even embroidering the truth, strictly speaking. It was the almost unconscious act of fictionalizing one's own life, and Thad didn't know a single writer of novels or short stories who didn't do it. You didn't do it to make yourself look better than you'd actually been in any given situation. Sometimes that happened, but you were just as apt to relate a story that cast you in a bad light or made you look comically stupid. What was the movie where some newspaper man had said, "When you've got a choice between truth and legend, print the legend"? The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, maybe. It might make for shitty and immoral reporting, but it made for wonderful fiction. The overflow of make-believe into one's own life seemed to be an almost unavoidable side effect of storytelling. Like getting calluses on the pads of your fingers from playing the guitar, or developing a cough after years of smoking. The facts of Stark's birth were actually quite different from the People version. There had been no mystic decision to write the Stark novels longhand, although time had turned it into a kind of ritual. And when it came to ritual, writers were as superstitious as professional athletes. Baseball players might wear the same socks day after day or cross themselves before stepping into the batter's box if they were hitting well. Writers, when successful, were apt to follow the same patterns until they became rituals in an effort to ward off the literary equivalent of a batting slump, which was known as writer's block. George Stark's habit of writing his novels longhand had begun simply because Thad forgot to bring any fresh ribbons for the Underwood in his little office at the summer house in Castle Rock. He'd had no typewriter ribbons, but the idea had been too hot and promising to wait, so he had rooted through the drawers of the little desk he kept down there until he found a notebook and some pencils, and in those days we used to get down to the place at the lake a lot later in the summer because I taught that 3-week block course. What was it called? Creative Modes. Stupid damned thing. It was late June that year, and I remember going up to the office and discovering there weren't any ribbons. Hell, I remember Liz bitching that there wasn't even any coffee. Home is where the start is. Talking to Mike Donaldson, the guy from People magazine, telling the semi-fictional story of George Stark's genesis, he had switched the location to the big house here in Ludlow without even thinking about it. Because, he supposed, Ludlow was where he did most of his writing, and it was perfectly normal to set the scene here, especially if you were setting a scene, thinking of a scene, the way you did when you were making a piece of fiction. But it wasn't here that George Stark had made his debut. Not here that he had first used Thad's eyes to look out at the world. Although it was here that he had done most of his work, both as Stark and as himself, it was here that they lived most of their odd dual lives. Home is where the start is. In this case, home must mean Castle Rock. Castle Rock, which also happened to be the location of Homeland Cemetery. Homeland Cemetery, which was where, in Thad's mind, if not in Alan Pangborn's, George Stark had first appeared in his murderous physical incarnation about 2 weeks ago. Then, as if it were the most natural progression in the world, and for all he knew it might have been, Another question occurred to him, one that was so basic and occurred so spontaneously that he heard himself mutter it aloud, like a shy fan at a Meet the Author tea. Why do you want to go back to writing? He lowered his hand until the tip of the pencil touched the paper. That numbness flowed back over it and into it, making it feel as if it were immersed in a stream of very cold, very clear water. Once more, the hand's first act was to rise again and turn to a fresh page in the journal. It came back down, creased the turned sheet flat, but this time the writing did not begin at once. Thad had time to think that the contact, whatever it was, had been broken in spite of the numbness, and then the pencil jerked in his hand as if it were a live thing itself. Alive, but badly wounded. It jerked, making a mark like a sleepy comma, jerked again, making a dash, and then wrote, "George Stark, George Stark, there are no birds, George Stark," before coming to rest like a wheezy piece of machinery. Yes, you can write your name, and you can deny the sparrows. Very good. But why do you want to go back to writing? Why is it so important? Important enough to kill people? "If I don't, I'll die," the pencil wrote. "What do you mean?" Thad muttered, but he felt a wild hope explode in his head. Could it possibly be that simple? He supposed that it could be, especially for a writer who had no business existing in the first place. Christ, there were enough real writers who couldn't exist unless they were writing or felt they couldn't. And in the case of men like Ernest Hemingway, it really came down to the same thing, didn't it? The pencil trembled, then drew a long, scrawling line below the last message. It looked weirdly like the voice print. "Come on," Thad whispered. "What the hell do you mean?" "Falling apart," the pencil wrote. The letters were stilted, reluctant. The pencil jerked and wavered between his fingers, which were wax white. "If I exert much more pressure," Thad thought, "it's just going to snap off." Losing necessary cohesion. "There are no birds. There are no fucking birds. I, you son of a bitch, get out of my head." Suddenly his arm flew up. At the same time, his numb hand flicked the pencil with the agility of a stage magician manipulating a card. And instead of holding it between his fingers most of the way down its barrel, he was gripping the pencil in his fist like a dagger. He brought it down. Stark brought it down. And suddenly the pencil was buried in the web of flesh between the thumb and first finger of his left hand. The graphite tip, somewhat dulled by the writing Stark had done with it, passed almost all the way through it. The pencil snapped. A bright puddle of blood filled the depression the pencil's barrel had dragged into his flesh, and suddenly the force which had gripped him was gone. Red pain raved up from his hand, which lay on his desk with the pencil jutting out of it. Thad threw his head back and clamped his teeth shut against the agonized howl which fought to escape his throat. 3. There was a small bathroom off the study, and when Thad felt able to walk, he took his monstrously throbbing hand there and examined the wound under the harsh glare of the overhead fluorescent tube. It looked like a bullet wound, a perfectly round hole rimmed with a flaring black smudge. The smudge looked like gunpowder, not graphite. He turned his hand over and saw a bright red dot, the size of a pinprick, on the palm side, the tip of the pencil. That's how close it came to going all the way through, he thought. He ran cold water over and into the wound until his hand was numb, then took the bottle of hydrogen peroxide from the cabinet. He found he could not hold the bottle in his left hand, so he pressed it against his body with his left arm in order to get the cap off. Then he poured disinfectant into the hole in his hand, watching the liquid turn white and foam, gritting his teeth against the pain. He put the hydrogen peroxide back and then took down the few bottles of prescription medicine in the cabinet one by one, examining their labels. He had had terrible back spasms after a fall he had taken while cross-country skiing 2 years ago, and good old Dr. Hume had given him a prescription for Percodan. He had taken only a few of them. He had found the pills fucked up his sleep cycle and made it hard for him to write. He finally discovered the plastic vial hiding behind a can of Barbasol shaving cream that had to be at least 1,000 years old. Thad pried the vial's cap off with his teeth and shook one of the pills out onto the side of the sink. He debated adding a second and decided against it. They were strong. And maybe they're spoiled. Maybe you can end this wild night of fun with a good convulsion and a trip to the hospital. How about that? but he decided to take the chance. There really wasn't even a question. The pain was immense, incredible. As for the hospital, he looked at the wound in his hand again and thought, "Probably I should go and have this looked at, but I'll be goddamned if I will. I've had enough people looking at me like I was crazy in the last few days to last me a lifetime." He scooped up another 4 Percodans, stuffed them into his pants pocket, and returned the vial to the medicine cabinet shelf. Then he covered the wound with a Band-Aid. One of the round spots did the trick. Looking at that little circle of plastic, he thought, you'd have no idea how badly the damned thing hurts. He set a bear trap for me, a bear trap in his mind, and I walked right into it. Was that really what had happened? Thad didn't know, not for sure, but he knew one thing. He did not want a repeat performance. 4. When he had himself under control again, or something approaching it, Thad returned his journal to his desk drawer, turned off the lights in the study, and went down to the second floor. He paused on the landing, listening for a moment. The twins were quiet. So was Liz. The Percodan, apparently not too old to work, began to kick in, and the pain in Thad's hand began to back off a little. If he inadvertently flexed it, the low throb there turned into a scream, but if he was careful of it, it wasn't too bad. "Oh, but it's going to hurt in the morning, buddy. And what are you going to tell Liz?" He didn't know, exactly. Probably the truth, or some of it, anyway. She had gotten very skilled, it seemed, at picking up on his lies. The pain was better, but the after-effects of the sudden shock, all the sudden shocks, still lingered, and he thought it would be some time yet before he could sleep. He went down to the first floor and peeked out at the state police cruiser parked in the driveway through the shears drawn across the big living room window. He could see the firefly flicker of 2 cigarettes inside. "They're sitting there just as cool as a pair of summer cucumbers," he thought. "The birds didn't bother them any, so maybe there really weren't any. Except in my head. After all, these guys get paid to be bothered." It was a tempting idea, but the study was on the other side of the house. Its windows could not be seen from the driveway. Neither could the carriage house. So the cops couldn't have seen the birds anyway. Not at least when they began to roost. But what about when they all flew away? "You want to tell me they didn't hear that? You saw at least 100 of them, Thad. Maybe 200 or 300. Thad went outside. He had hardly done more than open the kitchen screen door before both troopers were out of the car, one on each side. They were big men who moved with the silent speed of ocelots. "Did he call again, Mr. Beaumont?" the one who had gotten out on the driver's side asked. His name was Stevens. "No, nothing like that," Thad said. "I was writing in my study when I thought I heard a whole bunch of birds take off. It freaked me out a little. Did you guys hear that?" Thad didn't know the name of the cop who had gotten out on the passenger side. He was young and blonde, with one of those round, guileless faces which radiate good nature. "Heard 'em and saw 'em both," he said. He pointed to the sky, where the moon, a little past the first quarter, hung above the house. "They flew right across the moon. Sparrows, quite a flock of 'em. They hardly ever fly at night." "Where do you suppose they came from?" Thad asked. "Well, I tell you," the trooper with the round face said. "I don't know. I flunked bird surveillance." He laughed. The other trooper did not. "Feeling jumpy tonight, Mr. Beaumont?" he asked. Thad looked at him levelly. "Yes," he said. "I've been feeling jumpy every night just lately." "Could we do anything for you just now, sir?" "No," Thad said. "I think not. I was just curious about what I heard. Good night, you guys." "Night," the round-faced trooper said. Stevens only nodded. His eyes were bright and expressionless below the wide brim of his trooper's Stetson. "That one thinks I'm guilty," Thad thought, going back up the walk. "Of what? He doesn't know. Probably doesn't care. But he's got the face of a man who believes everyone is guilty of something. Who knows? Maybe he's even right." He closed the kitchen door and locked it behind him. He went back into the living room and looked out again. The trooper with the round face had retreated back into the cruiser, but Stevens was still standing on the driver's side, and for a moment Thad had the impression that Stevens was looking directly into his eyes. It couldn't be, of course. With the shears drawn, Stevens would see only an indistinct dark shape, if he saw anything at all. Still, the impression lingered. Thad drew the drapes over the shears and went to the liquor cabinet. He opened it and took out a bottle of Glenlivet, which had always been his favorite tipple. He looked at it for a long moment and then put it back. He wanted to drink very badly, but this would be the worst time in history to start drinking again. He went out to the kitchen and poured himself a glass of milk, being very careful not to bend his left hand. The wound had a brittle, hot feel. He came in vague, he thought, sipping the milk. It didn't last long. He sharpened up so fast it was scary, but he came in vague. I think he was asleep. He might have been dreaming of Miriam, but I don't think so. What I tapped into was too coherent to be a dream. I think it was memory. I think it was George Stark's subconscious hall of records, where everything is neatly written down and then filed in its own slot. I imagine that if he tapped my subconscious, and for all I know maybe he already has, he'd find the same sort of thing. He sipped his milk and looked at the pantry door. I wonder if I could tap into his waking thoughts, his conscious thoughts. He thought the answer was yes, but he also thought it would render him vulnerable again. And next time it might not be a pencil in the hand. Next time it might be a letter opener in the neck. He can't. He needs me. Yeah, but he's crazy. Crazy people are not always hip to their own best interests. He looked at the pantry door and thought about how he could go in there, and from there outside again, on the other side of the house. Could I make him do something, the way he made me do something? He could not answer that one, at least not yet, and one failed experiment might kill him. Thad finished his milk, rinsed his glass, and put it into the dish drainer. Then he went into the pantry. Here, between shelves of canned goods on the right and shelves of paper goods on the left, was a Dutch door leading out to the wide expanse of lawn which they called the backyard. He unlocked the door, pushed both halves open, and saw the picnic table and the barbecue out there, standing silent sentinel. He stepped out onto the asphalt walk which ran around this side of the house and finally joined the main walk in front. The walk glimmered like black glass in the chancy light of the half moon. He could see white splotches on it at irregular intervals. Sparrow shit, not to put too fine a point on it, he thought. Thad walked slowly up the asphalt path until he was standing directly below his study windows. An Orinco truck came over the horizon and pelted down Route 15 toward the house, casting a momentary bright light across the lawn and the asphalt walk. In this brief light, Thad saw the corpses of two sparrows lying on the walk, tiny heaps of feathers with trifurcate feet sticking out of them. Then the truck was gone. In the moonlight, the bodies of the dead birds became irregular patches of shadow once again. No more than that. They were real, he thought again. The sparrows were real. That blind, revolted horror returned, making him feel somehow unclean. He tried to make his hands into fists, and his left responded with a wounded bellow. What little relief he had gotten from the Percodan was already passing. They were here. They were real. How can that be? He didn't know. Did I call them, or did I create them out of thin air? He didn't know that either. But he felt sure of one thing. The sparrows which had come tonight, the real sparrows which had come just before the trance had swallowed him, were only a fraction of all possible sparrows, perhaps only a microscopic fraction. Never again, he thought. Please, never again. But he suspected that what he wanted did not matter. That was the real horror. He had touched some terrible paranormal talent in himself, but he could not control it. The very idea of control in this matter was a joke. And he believed that before this was over, they would be back. Thad shuddered and went back to the house. He slipped into his own pantry like a burglar, then locked the door behind him and took his throbbing hand up to bed. Before he went, he swallowed another Percodan, washing it down with water from the kitchen tap. Liz did not wake when he lay down beside her. Sometime later, he escaped into 3 hours of grainy, fitful sleep, in which nightmares flew and circled around him, always just out of reach.